Yeah, so first, let me just thank the organizers, both of the conference and of the Synthetic Quantum Matter program, which is running right now. I think it's a really, it's actually the first time I came for one of these extended programs, and I think it's really, really good experience, and it's a really good opportunity for collaboration and, you know, getting up to speed and everything going on. So I think it's really cool. Right, so I'll tell you today about this work. Who'd already read the title. So this work is done in collaboration with Frederik Nathan, a PhD student in Copenhagen who's here. So I put his picture. You can find him during the breaks. He did a lot of the heavy lifting in this project. And also, you know, Antonel Lindner from Technion, Eris Berg from Weizmann, and Gil Rafael at Caltech were all involved in this. And here are the two main references. And there'll be many background references which I'll give along the way, but the main results that I'll tell about, which are new, are in these two papers. Right. Okay, since I've been given the task of opening up this conference with the first talk, I thought I'd start with a bit of motivation and background just to get the ball rolling. So kind of my view on you know, this whole subject of designer quantum systems and synthetic quantum matter is, if you look at the last 10 or 15 years, let's say, there have been many great developments in condensed matter physics, both in theoretical fronts and experimentally. So in terms of theory, among other things, topology has really taken hold, not just as some occasional explanation for some interesting phenomenon, but really as a guiding principle for finding new phases and new types of phenomena in quantum systems. And that's led to, for example, discovery of the topological insulators, topological quantum computing, all kinds of interesting things. In addition, quantum dynamics, issues about thermalization, many body localization, these have all emerged in the last, you know, 10 or 15 years. And these developments, they're exciting, they bring many new opportunities, but also many challenges. You know, how can we probe these? How can we find materials or physical systems which realize these new behaviors? These are big open questions in the field. Okay. At the same time, experiments and experimentalists have made great progress in developing new tools, both for probing and for controlling quantum systems, both in solid state, in cold atoms, trapped ions, all kinds of contexts. So for me, really, this is kind of sets the stage of where we are now. And the question is, you know, how can we address these opportunities, these challenges? How can we, you know, use these new tools of experiments to try to get at, you know, cutting edge problems in condensed matter physics? So that's where, you know, so we're coming from. Now, one particular and, you know, increasingly popular approach to looking at this is to think about periodically driven systems. It's a new way of control. It's not new, but there are new ideas here of how we can control quantum systems and maybe realize new types of phenomena in this way. So there's an overarching question of what new types of robust many-body phenomena might we find in a periodically driven system. And you can go in different directions with this. For example, you know, in this sort of framework of topology, you might ask, can we somehow take a readily available but topologically not very interesting material and say by driving it with lasers, make it act, you know, inherit some of these topological properties of, say, a material like mercury telluride? Or somewhat more interesting from my point of view, and also what's sort of the theme of this talk, is are there some totally new, say, types of topological phenomena that may occur in a driven system which have no analog in equilibrium? It's not just that we're trying to use driving to find something that we knew should be there but didn't have the right material, but really identify a new phenomenon that occurs purely because of the driving and had no analog before. So this is what I will be focusing on in this talk. Okay, so the basic plan, as I mentioned, there are two main papers with some results, and I'll sort of tell about both. First is about, kind of as I just mentioned, topology that occurs sort of, I call it Floquet only. So it somehow it derives from the fact that the system is periodically driven, and we'll see in which way that happens. And then the second result about quantized magnetization density, which is a new phenomenon that occurs here in driven system. Okay. So when I talk about periodically driven systems, what I mean is a system with an explicitly time-dependent Hamiltonian, which repeats itself every driving period, called capital T, right here. And in such a system, you know, usually we're in, you know, in equilibrium, we think a lot about the Hamiltonian of a system. But if the Hamiltonian depends on time, then you know, thinking about eigenstates of the Hamiltonian isn't usually so useful. But the evolution operator of the system plays a very important role now. And in particular, when the system is periodically driven, there's a special evolution operator, which is the evolution operator that propagates the system over one complete period of the driving, capital T. It's called the Floquet operator. And it's useful because it's a discrete map for the dynamics, where if I have a state at time 0, I just apply this U of T, I get the state at time T, and I can apply the same operator again to get the state at 2T. So I have some stroboscopic dynamics where I'm applying the same operator again and again each period. And in that way, I regain some kind of time translation invariance of the evolution, of the sort of generator of evolution for this discrete time. I have a discrete time translation symmetry. And because of that, there's something like conservation of energy. But it's not energy. It's quasi-energy, which is basically just to say I can find eigenstates of this evolution operator for one period. And they will have eigenvalues, which are unit modulus complex numbers, which I can parameterize in such a way that this parameter here, it looks kind of like energy. This would be a dynamical phase that I would get normally, except that this is the eigenvalue of U, not just of H. And one really crucial property about this eigenvalue sitting here called quasi-energy is that in contrast to energy, which is, you know, a real number, it can be anywhere between minus infinity and infinity, this epsilon, this quasi-energy, is a periodic variable. If I would add 2 pi over capital T to this value of quasi-energy, I'd get the same physical eigenvalue back. So just like when I have a crystal, I don't have momentum anymore, but I have crystal momentum, which lives in a Brillouin zone. In a periodically driven system, energy lives in some kind of Brillouin zone. And this periodicity of energy is reflecting the fact that the system can absorb and emit quanta h bar omega from the driving field. So 2 pi over t is the driving frequency omega. Okay, so this periodicity of quasi-energy really plays a crucial role in distinguishing what can happen in driven and non-driven systems. So I just want to make that point. Okay, so I'm talking about non-interacting systems, by the way. I should have specified that. So suppose I have a system which is being periodically driven in time, and it's on a lattice, so I have translation symmetry in space, a discrete translation symmetry in space. Then I can find some kind of quasi-energy band structure describing motion of particles in the system. And once I have this, I can start to think in terms of analogies. So I could say there's probably some Hamiltonian which would give a very similar looking band structure. And just as we learned, you know, in the last decade, that bands can be topological, they can have all kinds of interesting properties. These bands of the Floquet operator, we can imagine, will have similar topological features. So this is something that, you know, was, I guess, 6-7 years ago, these ideas sort of came into being, and there's been lots of work studying this since then. But the really interesting thing is that in the driven system, things can be different. So consider a two-dimensional periodically driven system. There's a new situation which can occur, which is indicated here, where I have here are the bands of this 2D system. Now, this turn numbers of these bands can be zero, yet I still have chiral edge states living on the edge of the system. So in a non-driven system, the existence of chiral edge states is intimately connected with having non-zero values of these turn numbers. And there's, you know, there's a bulk edge correspondence which tells me if churn number is non-zero, I get edge states. If it's zero, I don't. And what we found was that, in fact, in a driven system, this doesn't have to be the case. So I could have what looks to be totally trivial bands, yet I still have chiral edge states living there. And this was the first indication that something really new is going to happen here. And you may ask, you know, what was it that broke down? You know, why did the argument from a non-driven system that told me I needed a non-zero churn number here to have an edge state, why doesn't that work anymore? And the point is that what this churn number tells you is actually not directly how many edge states you have, but it tells you the difference in the number of chiral edge states above and below a given band. And in a non-driven system, we know that there's no chiral edge state below the bottom of the lowest band because it would have to just shoot off to minus infinity. It has nowhere to stop. So I always have a place I can start counting. I have zero chiral edge states here. And then if I would know all churn numbers, I would exactly know how many edge states in each gap. In the periodically driven system, as I just emphasized a minute ago, quasi-energy is periodic. So I can actually have an edge mode that comes down out of this lower band, but it wraps around and comes back in the top. Therefore, knowing just these differences isn't enough. I need to know one more piece of information, which is how many edge states are sitting here. And that's why, that's sort of what really makes the crucial distinction between driven and non-driven systems. It really has to do with the fact that this energy-like variable is living on a circle, and it changes the features of a spectrum. So, you know, to illustrate how this occurs, there's a simple model that I'll present. It's sort of fine-tuned, but it illustrates some of the essential features. And later we'll discuss what happens if you go away from this fine-tuned point. But just to see how this can happen, consider the following procedure. So what I want to do is take a square lattice, and I'm going to drive the system by turning on and off hoppings on individual bonds. And so I'll do it in the following way. So in four steps. In the first step, I'll just turn on these red bonds, and I'll turn them on exactly for the time that if I would start, say, on this side here, I would make, with probability one, I would hop to this side and then turn it off. It's like a pi pulse of this hopping. Then I'll switch on these blue bonds and do the same thing. Leave it on exactly for the amount of time that it takes to hop from here to here and then turn it off, and then for the green, and then for the yellow. Okay, so if I do that, and I look anywhere, start on any side in the bulk of this sample, over one complete cycle, I'll just go around a plaquette and come back where I started. So the evolution operator, this Floquet operator, U of capital T, is just identity. You know, I start here, and I come back to the same site. In fact, there's no phase even. It's just one. Okay, so that's what characterizes the bulk. However, if I look on the edge, suppose I start on this site, in the first step, I would move here. Second step, I'm waiting for some bond which is here, but it's missing, so I just stay on that side. And then the third step, I move here. And in the fourth step, again, I'm missing this bond, so I just stay there. So the net effect of this full cycle is that I just move one full unit cell left on that edge, or right if I'm on this edge. And this shows that I have some kind of propagating, you know, chiral states living on the opposite edges. And the spectrum, sort of a caricature of it, is like this. Okay, so this illustrates this fact that, well, in the bulk, this evolution operator is completely trivial. It has no information contained in it at all, its identity. If I had done nothing and never turned on any hopping at all, I would get the same evolution operator here. But clearly something is going on because I have propagating states on the edge. Okay, so we studied this, and in this paper, we, you know, identified some kind of invariant. What this tells you is that, you know, just looking at this operator for the full driving period somehow isn't enough to really understand what's going on. We better look into the details of what goes on at all times in between, you know, the initial time and the full driving period. Okay, so there's some invariant which we found, which characterizes this and this paper here, but it's well, nothing wrong with it. But what I want to do is now tell you more modern, more recent view we have, which I think gives more insight into what's going on and allows generalization. So this picture here is kind of specific for this 2D system, but we can now understand better what's different, you know, what's really essentially different about topology in this system from a non-driven one. And it'll also give us means to generalize, say, including different symmetries, different dimensions, etc. So for this, I need to introduce a new kind of picture for you, which we call phase bands. So what I want to do is I want to look at the evolution operator of the system as a function of time. In particular, I want to look at its spectrum as a function of time. So at each, you know, at each instant, I can take the evolution operator that I have and just diagonalize it, you know, put it into some spectral representation. So this Pn is some kind of projector onto band n, momentum k, and then I have some phase. And I want to look at how this spectrum, you know, changes as I drive the system, from the initial time zero up until the full driving period. So at time zero, the evolution operator is always identity. I haven't done anything yet. So these phase eigenvalues all have to be zero or integer multiples of 2 pi. So that's what you see here. The spectrum starts. I can show this in some kind of repeated zone scheme. So I could have copies of the spectrum at 0, 2 pi, 4 pi, minus 2 pi, etc. Then as time evolves, this spectrum spreads out into some bands. And here, at the time capital T, which is the full driving period, the spectrum of this is just the quasi-energy spectrum of the system. So this is supposed to be some, you know, kind of section here showing that, you know, I get now some kind of smooth evolution between identity map and the Floquet operator of the system. So these are what we call phase bands. So it helps to start out by thinking, what would this phase band picture look like if I wasn't driving the system at all? What does it look like for an equilibrium system? So here, well, I know that I have, you know, I can diagonalize the Hamiltonian. I just get phases which wind linearly in time. So these phase bands are just some kind of sheets. They start out at 0 and 2 pi, and they just move apart from each other linearly as a function of time. So this is phase bands. This would be a 1D system. I have kx and time. These phase bands just form some kind of sheets which grow linearly like this. Now, if I drive the system, there's no reason that those sheets should be linear anymore. They may get some wiggles. Okay, so this is an example of what the evolution operator of a driven system may look like in terms of this phase band picture. And now there's a notion of topological equivalence. Suppose I fix what these phase bands look like at the end, my Floquet operator. I can consider a whole family of different time-dependent Hamiltonians, which give the same net evolution here, but different kind of wiggles in between. And in particular, I can smoothly just stretch these sheets until they're straight. And now I've found some equivalence relation between this driven system and the evolution of a non-driven system. So in that sense, the Hamiltonian which gives this is some kind of effective Hamiltonian which represents stroboscopic dynamics of this system. Okay? Now, the really interesting thing is something can happen in the driven system which can't in the non-driven one. And that's that in a non-driven system, if these phase bands cross, there's nothing which couples them. They just pass through as if they didn't even know each other are there. In the driven system, they can couple and become connected by some kind of singularities like this. And when that happens, there is no smooth way to deform this evolution to make it look like this because these two bands are connected to each other. And then we understand that in this situation, whatever my evolution is, it's somehow topologically distinct from this evolution here. Now, if I zoom in a little more, and I think, okay, I'm trying to think now about a two-dimensional driven system. This evolution operator depends on three parameters, kx, ky, and time. And so this sort of singularity point that I showed you, it actually is like a Weyl point. So, you know, a Weyl semi-metal. So I have somehow this evolution operator, if I zoom in, I can write it and I express it in terms of all three Pauli matrices, like this, to make this degeneracy. And then you see, if I make any smooth deformation, I can shift where this point occurs in, you know, k and time, but I can't get rid of it. It's really topologically protected. And so it turns out that you can, in fact, you know, classify evolution in terms of these singularities, and that, you know, gives a basis to, you know, develop some kind of new, say, periodic table of topological insulator, Floquet topological insulators, where now, in addition to computing, say, turn numbers of bands or whatever, Z2 invariants, I should also keep track of these singularities and how different symmetries can protect, say, pairs of them and restrict when they may not occur. Okay, so that's the first main result I wanted to tell you, is that these so-called topological singularities are what distinguish evolution operators of periodically driven and non-driven systems. Right, so that's, you know, what they're useful for. In addition, they're also useful, maybe useful, in the sense that if I want to design some evolution to do something non-trivial in a driven system, which couldn't happen in a non-driven one, now I understand that that will only be the case if I have such a point. So if I want to design the evolution, I better find some way of constructing a time-dependent Hamiltonian, which will generate such a singularity. Otherwise, whatever I get in the end will be sort of continuously connected with some phenomenon that could occur in a non-driven system. Okay, so that's end of part one. I could take questions on that now or hold them to the end. I don't know where you prefer, Ehud as the chair. Oh, maybe this is
So the veil points in the driven system, do they also have this property that they will come in pairs?
Well, it's interesting because this wild point is happening in kx, ky, and time space. So one of the partners could be sitting at a time which is before the driving period, and the other one can be after. And if it's after, you don't care about it, because we only care about what happens between 0 and capital T. So you don't have to have an even number within this window here. Okay, so we'll take more questions at the end. Otherwise, we may actually get off track. Right. Okay, so part two, now I want to tell you, it's not disconnected, actually, it's totally related to this phenomenon, is about this quantized magnetization density in fully localized Floquet systems. Okay, so this caricature of anomalous Floquet phase that I just gave you was kind of specific. It was fine-tuned. You know, we had this particle which exactly goes around one plaquette, but you can, you know, tune away from that very special point and still find that this behavior persists. Now, in particular, really the novel characteristics of this phase show their face if we add disorder to the system. So one of the interesting things about disorder in topological systems, say if I have chiral edge states in a non-driven system, it implies that I can't localize all bulk states. I can have some localized states, but I have to have at least some delocalized bulk state somewhere. One way to understand it is that, you know, if I have this chiral edge mode, it has some spectral flow, you know, it's flowing in energy, and something has to be there to stop it. Otherwise, it would try to just flow to, say, minus infinity. So this delocalized bulk state is there to sort of catch the chiral edge mode. In the driven system, again, we can use the fact that energy is periodic to allow this chiral mode to sort of wrap around the energy window and not have to terminate it. And so this is actually what's realized in this so-called anomalous Floquet-Anderson insulator, which is what you get if you take that, you know, special driving protocol I told you a second ago, you know, add disorder to it, change the parameters away from that fine-tuned point, it's okay. You'll find that you can have a situation where there are chiral edge modes, you know, running along edges of the system, yet all states in the bulk are localized. So it's a different situation than you get normally, and these chiral edge modes persist at all values of quasi-energy. So they just cut all the way through the quasi-energy Floquet zone. And one interesting feature is that then, if you fill all states near one edge of the system, a quantized current is carried. So this thing is closely related to a Thouless pump in the sense that the Thouless pump carries a quantized current, but now it's sort of, I've spatially separated modes that can propagate different directions. So this quantized current is even carried in a non-adiabatic driving regime. I don't have to be slow because I'm saved by localization of the bulk. Okay, so this, you know, we studied this before, and you know, there is some invariant now which can characterize even this localized system with disorder. In this phase bands I showed you a second ago relied on momentum conservation. But now I want to show you that, in fact, there's a quantized bulk observable which arises in such a system, which serves as essentially a topological order parameter. Okay, so this magnetization density that I'll tell you about is something that you can measure in an experiment and directly detect which topological phase you're in. So that's good. And also, given that it's an observable, it naturally generalizes, say, to the situation with interactions. Whereas, you know, previous invariants, which were based on the single particle evolution operator, it's not clear exactly how you should think about that in an interacting system. Okay, so first of all, just consider, for the sake of argument, same driving protocol we just discussed, but now with disorder added to it to localize all the states. And now we want to understand, you know, somehow there are different types of localized phases of this flow case problem. I can have two different flow case systems. Both of them are fully localized. All single particle flow case eigenstates, you know, are localized, but somehow they're topologically distinct. And we want to distinguish them now by the so-called micromotion. So what are these particles doing during the driving period? Somehow we know they don't fly away, but in one case maybe they just sit still, and the other they, you know, trace out some loops or something. So we can characterize this micromotion in terms of a magnetization, orbital magnetization carried by this particle, and that's what we're going to do. Now this would be magnetization of a single particle. It's kind of more useful to think in terms of magnetization density. So I can say, what's the sort of response of quasi-energy to putting a flux through a plaquette, as would be shown here. And what do I want to say? Right. So in the driven system and on the lattice, there is basically there's a lattice version of Ampere's law, right? Okay. So Ampere's law, which maybe I would write like this in a continuum, translates in this setting to saying that the current along some bond is the difference in magnetization densities on the adjacent plaquettes. You can see it's kind of a right-hand rule, right? If I have a current flowing here, there'll be some additional flux here and some weakened flux there. Okay, so that's sort of where this thing comes from. And we can use this to derive some quite strong results about magnetization density in this system. So first of all, I want to consider now a system on a torus. So there's no boundary. And suppose I just fill all sites. So all states are occupied. Then I know that the bond currents are all zero. Because in any bond, I have at any instant of time, you know, one particle going left, one particle going right, and they cancel. So in a fully filled system, there's no current. And by this Ampere's law, that means that the magnetization density is actually the same on every plaquette. Okay? It's the same, but we don't know what its value is, and it might depend on some parameters of the driving. It can depend on system size, etc. In fact, it can't depend on driving parameters, at least not very much, because this is a disordered system. I could have, say, you know, some driving parameters in this region and different driving parameters over here, but as long as all currents are zero, I know that the magnetization density has to be the same everywhere. So as long as I'm within this phase, in fact, there has to be some universal value of this magnetization density, but it still may depend on system size. So let me think about that for a minute. How could it depend on system size? Well, suppose I'm looking at magnetization density here around some point P, plaquette P, and now I grow the system by adding a bunch of sites somewhere on the opposite side, far away. Well, as long as I'm adding a bunch of localized states over here, they can only affect magnetization density here by their exponential tails, which reach this point. So in fact, this magnetization density has to be uniform in the system, and it can only depend at most exponentially weakly on system size. So there is some number, it's called m bar infinity, which characterizes the phase. It doesn't depend on any parameters as long as I stay fully localized. If I cross some transition where suddenly I get delocalized states, then, you know, this value can change. But as long as I stay within a phase where I'm fully localized, there's some universal value that will characterize the phase. And now I'll argue very briefly where it comes from. So this is the only sort of technical slide. I just wanted to show it because actually it's a very useful property here. It's kind of a neat trick. So there's this identity here, the log determinant of U, is actually the time-averaged trace of the instantaneous Hamiltonian. It's probably not so obvious if you haven't thought about it, but you can show it in one line, basically, maybe two. But the important point is that here we're looking at the trace of the Hamiltonian, and when I insert a flux, I turn on a magnetic field, it only affects off-diagonal elements of the Hamiltonian, say in a real space basis, right? So if I'm looking in a site basis, I insert some chiral phases on the hoppings, which are off-diagonal. So in fact, this log determinant of U can't change if I continuously turn on a magnetic field. So that's a very useful property. Now on a torus, I can't continuously change the magnetic flux that goes through it. I can only put full integer multiples of the flux quantum, corresponding to, you know, one monopole inside, two monopoles inside. So in fact, on the torus, I should only consider, say, a field of zero or a field corresponding to one full flux quantum through. And this relation tells me that the sum of all quasi-energies, which is what this log of u gives me, has to be the same in the two situations up to some integer multiple of 2 pi, basically. Okay, so the magnetization then, which is just, you know, response of quasi-energy to magnetic field, I can get by just, you know, replacing this derivative by discrete difference, and the limit that the system is very large, this field corresponding to one flux quantum through the whole torus is very tiny. So then this is a good estimate of the derivative, and I get that this magnetization then, magnetization density, if I divide by area, is just whatever this integer is that distinguishes sum of quasi-energy on the two sides, divided by capital T. And this integer, which appears here, is a topological invariant of the phase, and through somewhat complicated calculation, can be shown to be the same as the integer invariant discussed previously for this thing. But the good news is that this one is defined in terms of this sort of more physical operator, which A, can be measured directly, and B, we can try to extend it, say, to an interacting case. So just to mention, okay, so there's a quantized current that flows. Just I want to finish to say that we have an experimental proposal, a proposal for an experiment, how this could be measured, say, in a system of cold atoms. So far, there's been no spin in the problem, but now I want to have atoms with two internal states, which I'll just call spin. They could be anything. And I want to be able to apply a spin-dependent orbital magnetic field. And the reason is if I do that, then if I start in a state where all these atoms are polarized in plane, so I have sort of the x polarization of this spin, then suppose I turn on this spin-dependent field, which acts only on the, say, the down spins. Up spins are unaffected. When I do the evolution, those particles which, you know, those part of the superposition which have spin down will pick up an extra phase corresponding to the magnetic flux encircled by their trajectories, which will translate into a spin rotation. So it's kind of a Ramsey interference experiment. So basically, I evolve in the superposition, and if I just measure the rotation angle of the net spin of this, you know, cloud of atoms in the lattice, I'll find that it exactly gives me this quantized magnetization density times, you know, the number of periods that I've driven with proportionality of this b. Okay, so this is sort of proposal how this effect can be measured. And now the time is up, and it's good time because that's the end. So just put up the summary and take any questions that you may have. Thanks.
I have a question about the first part of the talk. When you mentioned the topological singularities in connection with the driven systems, are they singularities or crossover? And most importantly, can I relate them to some observable signature for the system?
Right, okay. So hopefully everybody heard the question. The question is about what is the nature of this thing that I call the topological singularity? Is it really a singularity? It depends what you want to use as a definition of singularity. I would say I can't think of a sense in which it's a smooth crossover. It's basically some kind of topological defect. Maybe I should call it that. So it's a topological defect in my Floquet bands, my phase bands, actually, not in the Floquet bands. It's a discrete object. Can only have integer numbers of them. And they're protected. Once it's there, I can't get rid of it by any smooth deformation unless, say, I merge two of them, or if I here sort of push it in time, I can push it all the way out here, but that would mean that I would close this quasi-energy gap and reopen it, and that's also a type of phase transition. Okay, so that's the nature of this thing. Now, in terms of observable signatures, what we show in this paper is essentially the bulk edge correspondence can be derived in terms of these things. So when this topological singularity exists here, it implies that there will be a chiral edge mode in this quasi-energy gap here. So if you can probe the spectrum, say at the edge, you'll see that this edge state is there. That's the most direct signature that I know.
It's also about this, I guess. So are these wild points the only thing that can happen in 2D? And what happens in 1D or are there 3D? I don't know. Some of this was the only example, I guess.
Right. Well, you know, the most generic thing is only two bands touching, and it's unlikely. You might consider some situation where more bands touch each other. There could be some other kind of protected degeneracy there. We haven't really explored it. It's an interesting point. In, say, 1D, you know, the wild point, the special thing about wild point is that we've used up all three Pauli matrices here. So if you had 1D, which, you know, 1 plus 1, then I can use two Pauli matrices, one for k, one for time. There's still some freedom, but if I have symmetry, say, constrains where the singularity occurs on certain lines, there can still be a protected degeneracy from that. So that's actually the way that symmetries are incorporated in this. You see that if I go to 1D and I impose some particle hole symmetry or something, it'll restrict these singularities to occur on certain lines, and so they can't annihilate each other without closing some gap.
How about 3D?
Yeah, you can also, 3D. Okay, 3D, you know, it's 3 plus 1. You can have something analogous to what happened in a 4D non-driven system. Okay, I need to think about it exactly what should be there. But there will be analogs of this thing occurring there.
So in this picture of topological singularities, this boundary connections, where do you actually use the fact that it's a Floquet system? Can't you just classify any driven system this way?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think Rahul Roy kind of takes that position that in some way, you know, whether it's periodically driven or not doesn't matter so much. I'm just classifying this evolution. For me, I think it is important that it's periodically driven, because, you know, this, if I want to look at some long-time dynamics, I need to know that I'm going to repeat this thing over and over again and find something interesting from it. If I would just, you know, take any random evolution and do this to it, I mean, I can, but then if I, you know, keep evolving past that given time, I don't know what's going to happen next. So I think most cases I can think of where it's useful, it's when I'm going to repeat this again and again and understand something on a longer time. But there's no reason you can't do it if that's the time frame you're interested in.
Yeah, and actually maybe a follow-up on this question. So in terms of observables, so what you're saying is that if you have this type of singularity during the evolution, the observable will be something that happens every period, right? So it doesn't sort of exist for all times. It's only sort of, it happens every period, right? So these chiral edge states, they exist at any moment of time or specifically when you have, you know, Floquet evolution?
Yeah, so the chiral edge state, you know, suppose I initialize a particle on the edge. During the driving period, it'll do something and it may go somewhat into the bulk. But actually, you know, given I have only a finite time, it can't go very far into the bulk because it has to get back to the edge by the end of the driving period. So there is some notion of an edge state which exists at all times and all times into the future if this is periodically driven.
Okay.
So can I just
follow up?
Yeah. So a short follow up. If I really look at a long time evolution of that sort without repeating, and you measure the integrated magnetization, it would still be quantized, presumably, regardless of the fact that it's not part of a longer repeated evolution, or that's not the case. So can you just...
Yeah, so the question about what happens to this magnetization density, so there's a subtlety which I didn't really go into. which is magnetization and magnetization density are only well defined in stationary states, where density doesn't change on average over whatever time you're looking at. So it's true for a fluky eigenstate. For a fully localized system, it's also true if you average over a long time, because particles, on average, don't move over a long time. If you just take some evolution over some whatever time window, and you had some random initial state, well, you have to find out, is it going to be in this stationary regime or not? And if it is, you'll find something quantized. But the meaning is, I'm not sure.
Yeah. Hi. In one-dimensional chiral systems, the topological invariant is the Zach phase, and it can be shown that in driven systems, the value of the Zach phase actually depends on the initial time that you choose the initial time of your periodic cycle, what's been called the time frame.
Right.
In this two-dimensional model, does anything depend on that?
For the 2D. For this, short answer is no. So this case we discussed, where there's no symmetries at all, there's nothing which depends on where you start in time.
Why? Is it easy to understand why?
I mean, this chiral symmetry is a funny kind of symmetry, which is in some way non-local in time. It relates evolution operator at, you know, beginning and end of the driving period in some way. It's kind of a funny object. Whereas if there's no symmetries, or say with particle hole symmetry, which is local in time, then this doesn't really happen, as far as I understand.
I think there's a question. Is my understanding correct that when you have this quantized magnetization, that what's happening is an effect that one electron is being taken around the circumference each period? I mean, it's not the same electron. They're all just shifting over one lattice space, let's say. Is that the correct way to think about it? And a second part of the question is, can one have fractional nu? I mean, fractional amounts of charge which rotate, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Right, good question. So on the first part, I think I wouldn't exactly characterize it that everybody shifts by one, because these are, this Floquet eigenstates are localized. So, each particle actually comes back to where it started. If I took your picture and I went for many periods, you would say that every particle actually eventually goes all the way around this blob, whatever it is. But in fact, each one stays, if they would be distinguishable, I could say each one stays close to where it started. Okay. So do I have a picture here? Yeah, let me consider this. Here's a situation. It's actually a numerical simulation here. I have a 80 by 80 system with an edge, and there's an edge state here. But I'm filling now a region 50 by 50 or something smaller than it. So in fact, all states in here are localized. I have no population on any delocalized edge state. Okay, so the only populated states are localized states. Each one sort of carries some small orbital magnetization. But there's no particle can actually propagate around. There is an edge current which flows around the boundary of this filled region, but it's actually because of uncompensated sort of local circulating currents. It's not from any delocalized state which is present. If I draw a picture, I have a bunch of... Yeah, that's right. And then you asked about fractional values of magnetization. There's, I think, not the answer you want, which is if you would fill this non-uniformly with some fixed density, then you would just get this quantized value, one electron per period, times whatever density you put there. If you want something more exotic, which is stabilized by interactions, it's a good question. It's something we're thinking about. Maybe some kind of time crystal-like behavior could do it, but don't have a definite answer yet.
Just quickly following up on Andrew's question.
Can you take the mic?
Quickly following up,
possible to say something universal about total magnetization, because edge currents will also contribute to magnetization, right? So can you tell anything about, again, if I'm measuring from far away, basically, my total magnetization of the sample?
Yeah, okay, so it depends on how you fill now. So in this example, where we've purposefully not filled the edge state, then total magnetization is just basically area of this thing times the magnetization density. Now, I mean, actually, historically, the way we got to this was thinking about the fully filled system, where you filled the edge state and all the bulk. There, as I mentioned earlier, if all sites are filled, there's no current on any bond in the system. And if there's no current in any bond in the system, that means the magnetization is zero, in fact. So what it tells you is that the magnetization carried by this loop of current of the edge state exactly cancels the magnetization of all these localized states inside. So it's one way to actually to derive, you know, what is magnetization density, is to say the edge state carries I, you know, I times A, just Ampere's law, and then magnetization density is of the bulk states is the minus of that.
If not, let's thank Mark again. And, go on to the next talk, on Kayser Lake, on out of equilibrium analogs of symmetry protected topological phases of matter.